Thank you, Dennis. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous am I sober this day, and for this I am so thankful. And first of all, I want to thank your committee for allowing this alcoholic to be here this weekend and sit and listen to some tremendous presentations, questions and answers about our being and how it works and why it works and the reason that we need to keep passing it on. And also allow this alcoholic to share this alcoholic with you and you with this alcoholic. And I want to thank Gay and Keith for picking me up at the airport and delivering me here to you wonderful people. The only thing I know about being an alcoholic is how I drank alcohol. And the only thing I know about living sober is Alcoholics Anonymous. And since April the 20th of 1967, I have not found any reason whatever to leave Alcoholics Anonymous to find an easier way to live sober, a more sociably acceptable way to live sober, a more fun way to live sober, nor a more comfortable way to live sober. Thank God I haven't had to go to one of those action-reaction courses, Confrontation Movement, Related Disorders Institute. When I got to you people, my mother-in-law was a related disorder. Hang in there till your drawers fall off, baby. Sexual dysfunction seminars. If you get as old as I am and stay sober as long as I have, I do not need a sexual dysfunction seminar. I need a memory course. And the only way I know how to live sober are the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know no other way. Well, it was on the last Sunday, and as it was read so beautifully a while ago from portion of chapter 5, that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now. It was on the last Sunday in August of 1950, over 37 years ago, that a group of fine, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an open AA meeting at the Suburban Group in Dallas, Texas. The Wednesday before that Sunday, I stumbled into one of Dallas's more affluent barber shops, and I fell in his chair at this manicurist table. Now, I was more at myself that morning. Now, more at myself in those days meant that I was drinking. I wasn't too drunk. I could sit in a chair for about 10 minutes without falling out of it. I could navigate to and from the men's room, maybe, and go out and get me another bottle of whiskey. I sat down in this chair, and this gal looked at me, and she said, "David," and right there and then I should have known something's wrong. She didn't call me doctor. She said, "David, I belong to a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have not had a drink of alcohol in a year." And I looked at Edith, and I said, "You are a liar. Nobody stays sober a year, maybe a day, maybe 2 days, 3 days at the most, but not a year." She said, "No, I haven't had a drink in a year." Now, Edith looked like a drunk ought to look like. Sort of female-looking dentist over here, you know. Her face wasn't real pretty. It looked like a truck had run over it and then backed over it to see if it done a good job. She had big bug eyes and gaps in her teeth, and God bless her, she'd been hit in the face so many times and fallen on her face so many times drunk, and her nose had been broken so many times, just sort of leaned on the left side of her face. Now, this is back in the days before the gals used to wear pantyhose. You used to wear garter belts to pull their drawers down and keep the socks up, you know. And when she was drinking, hers always trailed behind her uniform, and she'd trip and fall and drop all them manicuring bottles. And back in those days, the gals used to wear a hose with seams up the back. You could always tell when Edith was drunk. The seams was in the front, and the front was in the back. But basically, the best way I can describe Edith's looks as a drunk in our part of the country, if your car is caught out in a hailstorm and is pretty badly beaten up, right when you get your insurance check, if you have insurance, some wise buzzard says, "Don't get it fixed. Let it sit out in the hot sun for about 3 or 4 weeks, and all the dents will pop back out." Her dents never pop back out. But God, she's a great gal. But when Edith told me she had not had a drink of alcohol in a year, that got my attention. Because Edith had a bad reputation of being a mean, active, drinking drunk. And Edith was a pint drinker. And she had a big purse, and she always had 2 pints of whiskey in her purse. And nobody could get in that purse. And she'd kill you if you got in that purse. But when she told me she hadn't drank in that year, I looked at her and I said, "Uh-oh, something has changed for this gal. Something has changed." And I noticed it, and it changed. Now, the change was not that dramatic that moment, because I had stumbled in that shop on frequent occasions. Sometimes drunker than I was that morning, sometimes not as drunk, but always drinking alcohol. But when she told me she hadn't had a drink, I started watching her, and I noticed she changed. I noticed that morning when she started to give me my manicure, she was buffing my nails instead of my knuckles as she used to. I looked up at her face, and her lipstick was on her lips and not her eyebrows. And I sniffed her, and she didn't smell halfway between an Avon woman and a whiskey bottle. But more important, she did not grab her purse and say, I'll be back in 10 minutes and maybe show up 9 months later. But I noticed the change, and the change was in her eyes. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have two kinds of eyes. We have those sad, sick eyes. And then we have those happy, dancing, laughing, sparkling, sober eyes. And then we have another kind of eyes, them glassy eyes. They'll get up behind one of these things, say, I haven't had a drink, you know, and then fall over. But her eyes were sparkling, and they were jumping, and they were laughing, and she looked like she was having a lot of fun living sober. And then she turned to another manicurist in the same shop next to the tables of hers, and she says, now, Moena here is my sponsor, and she has 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at Moena, and I said, Moena, you are a bigger liar than Goofy over here. I said, Moena, we had a drink not. And she says, no, David, I have not had a drink of alcohol with you or anyone else or myself in 15 continuous months. Edith has not had a drink of alcohol in 12 continuous months. And we have an open meeting this Sunday at 5:30 in the afternoon. And it's open to this meeting, and it's open so that those who are not members of Alcoholics Anonymous can come and see how an alcoholic lives sober in the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to find out what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what Alcoholics Anonymous is not. And believe it or not, the greatest challenge that we have right this very essence of time within Alcoholics Anonymous all over this world, that there are hundreds of thousands of our members who do not know what Alcoholics Anonymous is not, that we're not all things for all people. The singleness of purpose has brought us where we are today. But I had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. And she says, although we do not give any honors or awards or medals for our sobriety, it is the custom of the group, being it is the last Sunday of the month, that after the AA meeting, they have a sort of a little birthday celebration for those who have one or more years of continuous sobriety. And we would like for you and your wife to come to that meeting and stay afterwards for that little birthday celebration. And I thought that the only reason that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA meetings and stay to one of your AA functions, that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and successful professional man come and upgrade you crazies in the community. And I was glad to come help you. So I went home and I told my wife, and God, she was thrilled, because people had long since quit asking us around. My wife, Grace, used to ask me, why isn't it we're not asked to the outdoor barbecues and square dances and round dances and nightclub supper parties and, you know, and card parties and swimming pool parties and pin the tail on the donkey, whatever drunks do on Saturday night. And I said, it's you. It's you. I said, every time we're asked to go out on Saturday night, you start on me on the Monday before, and you start screaming, you're not going to drink. You're not going to get drunk, are you? You wake me up out of a sound sleep, 5 o'clock the next morning, screaming, did you hear what I said? And you keep it up Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, and what a tremendous price society's had to pay, is paying, and I guess will always pay. Those who love us, those who hate us, those who do not even care we exist on this earth. What a tremendous price those people are paying and will pay to find out that the more you scream at our kind about our drinking and alcohol, the more we're going to drink. And I said, and furthermore, when we get to where we're supposed to get to, before I can even park the car, you're out of the car. You run in, you grab the host and the hostess, and you chase them out of the kitchen, through the den, in the backyard, in the alley, in the bushes, in the neighborhood, in the garbage, screaming, don't you give him a drink. Woman, you're sick. That's what's wrong with you. But through tear-filled eyes, she said, are we going to the meeting? And I said, yes. And so that Sunday morning, I got up at 5:30 in the morning to get ready to go to an AA meeting 5:30 that afternoon. Well, now, what does a good, self-respectful drinking drunk do when he gets up 5:30 on Sunday morning? Drinks whiskey, that's what he does. Let's face it, it's very simple. Golfers golf, fishermen fish, drunks drink. There's no big mystery. And I started sucking on a brand-new bottle of whiskey. You know how it is when you take that first drink, that gets you breathing started. Then that second drink regulates your breathing. Then that third drink goes down to both heels and just sets you there. Now you're ready to do some real drinking, aren't you? And I'm drinking, and I'm looking up at the birds and the bees and the trees and the sky, and I'm hearing the neighbor screaming, Johnny, get dressed, we'll be late for church. And I said, oh, them sick folks, they don't know what living really is. And then I went in, I drank about half of that fifth whiskey, put the other half, the fifth, in the trunk of my car, because I knew at that time that I was going to be required to have another drink of alcohol that later on that day, not knowing the exact reason until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that if and when an alcoholic comes to us, that until and unless that alcoholic is willing to find out what's wrong with that alcoholic, That alcoholic will never be able to find out what can get right with that alcoholic. And I went in and I bathed and I shaved and I put on everything rich and nice looking to impress those poor sick people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Put on a beautiful brand new tailor-made suit, white on white monogram shirt, monogram handkerchief, monogram tie, monogram drawers. Put on my diamond ring, my diamond watch, and the trademark of every good, self-respectful, high-rolling drinking drunk. A brand new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. I look just like a used car salesman. And at 10:30 in the morning, I'm out in my long Roadmaster Buick honking the horn. And out comes my wife with the rollers in her hair. And she has on It's That All Your Fault kimono that they just love to live in and dwell in and die in and cry in. If I hadn't have married you, I wouldn't have gotten down to this. To where she'd lost the string around the middle and it's pinned together with a big baby diaper pin. And she's pulled all the threading and the padding and the fuzzing and the buttons off the front. And the front's just covered with tear stains and cigarette burns. In Alcoholics Anonymous, us loving drunks call that lovingly the Al-Anon's designer house coat. And my loving wife looked at me in a very quiet and kindly and loving voice. She screamed out, "What do you want, you sorry drunk?" Meanwhile, all the neighbors had gathered out. And her side is lined up over here, and my side is lined up over here. And I can still hear the fine ladies of the neighborhood saying, "Isn't it a shame that such a beautiful and fine lady and the mother of two beautiful little boys married to such a sorry, no-good drunk like him?" And my bunch over here hollering out, "Let her have it, David, let her have it." And that used to be the weekend entertainment in every neighborhood we lived in. We moved 24 times before we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes at midnight, sometimes at high noon, sometimes at daybreak, sometimes ahead of the sheriff, sometimes with the sheriff, sometimes behind the sheriff, just kept moving. I said, "Let's go to the meeting." And she says, "It doesn't get started for 7 more hours, you stupid drunk." And with that, she turned on her heels and went back into the house. And that started 7 tough hours because I violated a very serious code in my drinking that day. It was Sunday, and I'm sucking on the only bottle of alcohol that I have. I had drank half of it. The other half was in the trunk of the car. I knew I was going to have me a drink. But I was one of them kind of drinking drunks that when I drank, I rolled her all the way. And one of the biggest problems I had before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous that people used to pull me off my drunks green, and I was not through drinking. And I'd come in, and I'd cry, and I'd paw my foot, and I'd make promises, and I'd make pledges, and I'd wait till they tucked some more money in my shirt pocket or a check. And as soon as they turned their back, I'd flee to finish the drunk. And I was a stay-away-from-home kind of drunk, not on purpose. I'd get drunk, and I'd end up in countries that I never even knew existed in the world, with people I never saw before in my life, sometimes with clothes on, sometimes without clothes on, sometimes with money, sometimes without money. I remember one time I was gone 9 months. No one knew where I was. My mother, my father, my wife, my sons, my patients, my enemies, my friends, and no one knew where I was. And I come running in the house with the same clothes on I guess I'd been in for around about 5 months. And I asked my wife this brilliant question, "Did anybody call?" And that does not make for good marriage relationships, I'll tell you. I knew that I didn't want to touch that whiskey in the trunk, and I knew if I wanted to get some more being Sunday, I'd either have to call a taxi cab and find a bootlegger. And I knew, and so I just found just enough around the house and outside in the bushes, you know, just to kind of nurse me along and keep the edge going. Because, you see, I knew that if I went and got drunk, I'd blow the deal. Because, and I knew that those drunks that were sober and members, and that, in other words, my ego demanded that I take my wife to that meeting. And the reason my ego demanded that I take my wife to that meeting, just in case it's those two ladies who said they were alcoholic and that they were sober and that they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they invited us to come to meet some more people who would say they were alcoholic and that they were sober and that they were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just in case those people had a mild suspicion that I may have a minor problem with alcohol, I wanted to bring them the reason and show them the reason, and that was my wife. And I knew if I continued the deal, I'd blow the deal, and them drunks would be on me just like gum on the heel of your shoe. Because when I got out of the service the first time in 1947, the sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas tried to net me. They tried to net me in 48. They tried to net me in 49. They tried to net me in January of 50, and they thought they set the trap on the last Sunday of August of 1950. So I found just enough to nurse me and keep the edge on. And finally at 4:30, I honked the horn, and here she came, and off we went. And we went in. I parked the car. We went in this group. There must have been about 80 members of Alcoholics Anonymous and their wives and the kid and a poodle or two jumping up and down. And everybody smoking cigarettes and grinning and laughing and scratching and hugging and kissing. And I stepped back and I looked at those people and I said, by gosh, if they're alcoholic and they are not drinking alcohol and they are that happy, then they have to be on dope. And then I looked around and I saw all them signs in an AA group and I says, my God, I'm in a kindergarten. And then I saw, but for the grace of God, my head ducked. Because I knew at that time that I was not living according to dictates of God's will for a human being. And I'm one of these that firmly believes that if and when an alcoholic comes to us, even though many of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous without a full string of lights, that after we get here, after we get physically comfortable from alcohol, that deep down inside, every one of us know this. That if there's one failing that many of us fail to remember, is that every one of us were born human beings first. If this be the case, not the case, our spiritual recovery would not be what it is today within us. I defy any alcoholic, any place, anywhere, to bring me their birth certificate and show me where they were born alcoholic. If you look at your birth certificate, it says you're born alive. Which means as a human being, we come with everything that human beings come with. As I said before, if this be not the case, then Alcoholics Anonymous would not be the most precious, the finest recovery program and fellowship for an alcoholic that the world has seen, is seen, or ever will see. Because Alcoholics Anonymous does something that formalized, organized religion has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Medicine has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Psychiatry has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Social services has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Government agencies has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Treatment modalities has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Human willpower has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Hypnosis has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Acupuncture has not, is not, will ever be able to do it. Because Alcoholics Anonymous reaches down into the innermost, finest depths of a human being that comes with each and every one of us at birth. This most precious little thing as a human being that after we get physically sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, this precious little thing says to us in time, thank you, little alcoholic, for not taking a drink of alcohol today. Thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a way to have a reasonably good night's sleep. But more important, thank you, little alcoholic, for finding a group of people who love you no matter what you have done, what you are doing, or what you ever will do. And this is where the great power of our society lies. One drunk talking to another. But I had many, many years to go before I was to realize this. And I found just enough to nurse me along, you know. As I said, I walked in. Then I saw what I then believe in that group. To be right this very essence of time, the most dangerous sign that you can put in an AA group, and that's the one that says think. Because it's dangerous for our kind of folks to think drunk, sober, or dead. And if you don't believe it, you pat a little drunk on the head and tell them how he or she is good they're doing in AA and out of AA and let them get over in the corner and start thinking for themselves and they'll get drunker than an $8 bill on you. They blew a whistle, they hollered, they did something. Everybody went in the meeting and I went and I sat on the back row to see, look those folks over to see what kind of help they needed. The first talker got up and it was a woman and I fell out of my chair because that's a lying, this cheating, this person I'd ever been around in my life. And that lady had nerve enough to stand up in front of 80 people and say she was sober, sane, in her right mind and had not had a drink of alcohol in a year. And I jumped up and I screamed out, you are a liar. And somebody said, shut up. You know how a wet drunk answers you when you tell him shut up? Make me. Well, they had enough in there to make me. And then that woman started talking about a miracle, miracle, miracle. What seemed to me like 10 minutes on the one word miracle, but after I got sober and I looked back in my life, I realized maybe it's 3 seconds, 4 seconds. I couldn't stand it. This time I tried to get up on the chair, fell off of it 3 or 4 times, finally got up, held on the wall, pointed a finger, screamed at her, tell it, you big liar. And this time the put down, the shut up was firmer. And then that lady said, as a result of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, she caught Christ back in her life. And if anyone who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, unless they found that Christ is the truth and Jesus is their power greater than themselves, that there was no way in this world that they could stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself at that time, what a heck of a trick to pull on a Jew. That y'all invited me to this deal to convert me. And if this is what you were, I needed a drink real bad. And I'm asked all the time all over this world, how come there are not any more Jews and Alcoholics Anonymous than what there is? Well, you see, it's very simple. You see, the way people have their noses fixed and their names changed, you don't know who you're sitting next to in an AA meeting. But my mind closed and I didn't hear anything else that was said at that meeting because I violated a very serious code in my drinking and my living. Because I started drinking with, working with, get drunk with, fighting with, cheating with the black and the white wino, which was then Skid Row today, and I guess it'll always be Skid Row in Dallas, Texas. And I've lived on three Skid Rows in my lifetime, one for over 6 years, one for over 4.5 years, but the last one, 14 months, was the toughest. And I am not going to stand up here tonight and lead a blow-by-blow through Skid Row. The Skid Rows that I lived on, there was no night and there was no day. And there was no sky and there was no sun and there was no moon and there were no stars and there were no clouds. And there were no seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, just total inner and outer blackness and darkness. And the best way I can describe that kind of an existence is just bodies and feet. And you don't care if you live, you don't care if you die. You don't care if you eat, you don't care if you don't eat. You don't care if you sleep, you don't care if you stay awake. You don't care if you see your loved ones, you don't care if you don't see your loved ones. You just don't care. And an alcoholic cannot stay on Skid Row. An alcoholic has got to get off of Skid Row. Because an alcoholic will lie about that alcoholic's drinking. An alcoholic will hide that alcoholic's bottle. And I'll tell you right now, if you don't share your bottle down on the road, you're not long for this earth, I don't mind telling you. And I did not have to be down there, because I came from one of the finest families that God ever put on this earth. As a son, I was blessed with the most beautiful mother and father that any son could ever wish for, hope for, desire for. A mother and father who dedicated their two lives to give the two sons that were born of that marriage everything that was denied them when they were growing up. And if one of the sons is going to become an alcoholic, I do not know of a better deal when you've got a mother and father that's willing to go to any length to keep you from hurting and keep you from suffering. In 14 and a half years before I got sober in the religion my mother and father were born in, lived in, died in, very devout. They lit the candles of the dead and said the prayers of the dead for 7 consecutive days. And on the 8th day, they said the final prayer of death, snuffed out the flame in the candle, and as far as they were concerned, I was dead. That I was no longer alive in their minds on this earth. And that was the greatest thing in the world they could have done for them about me. That was total release. And I had no communication with them for 19 years total. After I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and beginning to take and try to live the steps in the recovery program in order in which they're written and they follow. And then I got to the 4th step, and I was told to write my inventory. And I always thought that one grew spiritually, how humble one was on one's knees in sackcloth and ashes and begging God forgiveness for everything bad that we've done. But I read in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous how we grow spiritually in AA. That resentment is the number one offender, and from it stems all sorts of spiritual disease. Now, what do we mean? First we resent, then we get mad, then we get angry, then we get frustrated, then we feel sorry for ourselves. And until we overcome the spiritual malady, only then will we straighten out mentally and physically. Now, there isn't an alcoholic in this meeting right this very second that didn't straighten out physically before we got here, many, many times. But why couldn't we straighten out physically? Because we had no way to straighten out mentally as an alcoholic. And so why are we sober if we're living the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and not drinking? It's because we are overcoming the spiritual malady one day at a time. And when I got to that 4th step and I started writing about the resentments and the hates that I had against my mother and father, because of the manner in which they treated my brother is opposite to me. And when I put those resentments down, I looked at them honestly. I found out that up until the time my mother and father prayed me dead, they were the worst parents that I could have ever possibly have had, because they never allowed me to fall. They broke every fall. And yet I could not fault them, because they were doing the best they knew how. I certainly couldn't. But I had many, many years to go before I was to realize all this. I certainly did. I learned a lot of things down on Skid Row. Never got started drinking down there 10 1/2 years of age. Started drinking bay rum and wine. That was the standard fare. Later on, as I grew older and physically and got more money in my pocket, I'd go from that bay rum and that wine to that good stuff and never miss a lick. Come back down from that good stuff down to Gypsy Rose and Thunderbird and never miss a lick. I don't know about anybody in here. I wasn't drinking it because of the price of it. I wasn't drinking it because of the smell of it. I wasn't drinking it because it was sociably acceptable. I drank it because I liked what it did to me and with me and for me when it got in and down and through me. And I liked what it allowed me to do to you or against you when it got in and down and through me. And little did I realize that the first drink of alcohol that I took, it affected this alcoholic's head that says, David, every chance you're going to get, you're going to take a drink of alcohol to reproduce that initial effect. And I certainly did not know this. I learned a lot of other things down on Skid Row. Never get your back up against the wall. Didn't have a back door window you could jump out of. And if you drank that wine like I did, it'd hang you without a rope. I don't mind telling you. If you smoke or eat anything, keep both hands free so you can hit and run. I've always been 5'6". I was born 5'6". And I'd drink that juice and I'd be 7 foot tall. I've had hundreds of fights, never won a one. My nose has been where my navel is. My navel's been where my right ear is. I've been all rearranged. When I was 14, 15, 16 years of age, I ran off and joined Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus. And back in those days, the Ringling Show was the finest show under canvas in the entire world. And it would have been a thrill for a youngster to go with the circus in those days. But I went because you could drink and you could fight. And I look around here and I don't see any circus-looking drinkers. I learned to drink the most beautiful concoction in the circus that's ever been devised by a man called Green Lizard Circus Style. A tremendous drink. Elixir of sodium bromide and Lucky Tiger hair tonic. And I used to drink that stuff, and I'd see Bambi and those animals in Technicolor long before Walt Disney ever put them on screen. But I'm trying to live three codes of living in those days. I'm trying to live the code of living that society was demanding that I live, to go to school and become a useful human being, and not end up in jails and goonie roosts and missions and try to be of service to my God and my country and my fellow man. And then I'm trying to live the code of living my mother and father wanted me to live, and they had all the money. And if you had already been in all the trouble I had been in, was in, and getting ready to get into, it takes a lot of money to get you out so you can get back in it again. And then I'm trying to live the code of living that alcohol was demanding on my life, and you're way ahead of me. You know which one went out. And so here I am. I'm sitting on the back row. There's no window. There's no door to jump out. That woman talking about Christ, and I want to drink so bad it's killing me. And every time I stood up to walk through those 80 people to go out to the trunk of my car to get me a drink of whiskey, it looked like 80 people stood up, turned around, pointed their fingers at me and said, shut up and sit here and listen, and this is for you. And I hated every member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was in that meeting and the horse and wagons that brung them cross country. And I made a deal with them people in Alcoholics Anonymous right there and then. If they were not going to give me a good drink of alcohol right there and then in the meeting and let me drink it in the meeting, or to go out to my car and take a real good drink and come back in, that I was not going to listen to anything that those people had to say. And that deal darn near killed me. And it wasn't until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous 17 years later, a hulk of a human being. And I hope I never forget it. And I come in and they shove the book of Alcoholics Anonymous in my hand. May I remind every member of Alcoholics Anonymous in this meeting right this very second, every Al-Anon, if we have some Alateens, and if there's any guests here that are not members of any of the cooperating fellowships, but are our friends, it is the only book in print with the two words on it. There's not another book like it, greater than, more than, less than. If it's not it, it is not it. Now, I do not know about you, but I wonder how many of us stop and realize that when we admit to or tell anyone, in AA or out of AA, that we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, how many times do we stop and realize that when we do that, we admit we are the results of what's in that book? Because within the pages and the covers of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the entire recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not taken out of context. Now, I don't know about you, but tonight when I retire, after I take my 10-step inventory of this day about David, and then turn to the God of my understanding and thank him for allowing a monkey like me to live sober this day in spite of me, I ask myself, what kind of member of Alcoholics Anonymous have I lived this day? Am I one of these who's had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? Or am I one of these who wants you to believe that I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, that can quote all the pages and all the promises and all the commas and all the facts and all this and all that and look real good on the outside but without a concrete block in the middle of the belly big enough to land a DC-10? Have I lived this kind of day that it's a privilege to sit at the bedside of a wet drunk or sit and talk with each other in Alcoholics Anonymous, those that are having a tough day living sober, and sit down particularly to the wet drunk and just tell them about David, of what it used to be like, what's like now? Have I lived that kind of life? And that drunk looks at me and he says, yes, I want what you people seem to have, and I'm willing to pick up my bed and walk with you. And every night I take that inventory, I find that I fall far short for what this alcoholic believes to be the true benefits of our recovery program. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're asked to share our experiences, not our opinions. Because we find as a result of our experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous that opinions in many, many instances have a tendency to make sick people sicker. And in some instances, to physically kill people. We've been given a tremendous gift to be free to share ourselves in good taste with another human being. And that is a tremendous freedom for our kind of people. And so as a result of it, you know, and I started reading, and they used to call me boy in that group. They said, boy, bring that book to us. And I take the book to them, and they say, what's on the bottom of that dust cover? And I said, it says, this is the basic text. They said, that's where you start. Then they said, open the book and turn to the first page. And I did, and the first page is a fly leaf, and it's vacant. There's nothing on it. And they say, what's on that page? And I said, nothing. And they said, do you know why nothing's on there? And I says, no. He says, because you do not know nothing. They said, if you knew anything about living sober, you wouldn't need the book. Then they said, turn two pages over and read to us what year was the book you're holding printed. And I told them the year it was printed. And they said, now, David, now we're going to give you the key. And they said, the key is, David, that there are thousands of alcoholics such as you who have come to AA, are coming to AA, and will come to AA, that will try to change what's in that book. David, the key to living sober in the AA way of life is let what's in that book change you as a result of the living experiences of the members of your group and other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, now we want you to start reading that book from the front. Don't you turn the back and read them stories at the end of the book, because you're not the end of your problem. And don't open it up in the middle of the book, because you're not in the middle of your problem. You start at the front. Well, being unemployable practically in those days, when my eyes got uncrossed, I started reading the book. And they said, we're going to ask you a question. So I started reading the book. And I got to the doctor's opinion, and being part of the medical profession, that interested me immensely. Here was a little physician by the name of Dr. William Silkworth, who treated over 40,000 alcoholics before AA got started and over 10,000 alcoholics after AA got off the ground. A little physician psychiatrist, in his day, he was one of the two most outstanding physician medical psychiatrists in North America. A physician who loved the drunks. A physician who forsake fame and fortune to stand at the firing line of our kind of people. Dr. Silkworth wrote the first paper about the physical nature of our illness that was put in print. And he didn't believe that mental control alone would solve the deal. He's the first one that talked about the phenomenon of craving. And Silkworth writes what this alcoholic believes to be 2.5 pages of the finest writing about our malady as we understand it in AA that's ever been put in print. It has to be, because it has stood the acid of time. And today it is the basis of every successful treatment modality in the world today for alcoholics. And Silky writes, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. My God, that shot the balloon out of the air. I thought I was drinking because of the kind of woman I was married to. I thought I was drinking because of them two rotten kids. I thought I was drinking because the Republicans was in and the Democrats was out. I thought I was drinking because of my color, my size, my hair, my religion.
I thought I was drinking because I was recalled back into the service. No, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And although we will admit it is elusive, we will admit that it is injurious, there comes a time when we cannot differentiate the true from the false. And then the alcoholic believes his life to be the only one. Well, doesn't every alcoholic get drunk on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, St. Paddy's Day, when the sun goes up, the sun goes down, the sun just lays there? A drunk can be passed out 3 weeks right here on his back on this floor. You kick him, wake him up. Been drinking? 2 beers, and he falls back down. Never one, never three, never five. Silky writes, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. I never was restless and irritable and discontented. When I was drinking, I was drunk. It's in between drunks that I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And until we could again experience the ease and comfort which seems to come at once. Drinks that we see others taking with impunity. My wife used to ask me, why don't you drink like Herman? I said, I don't want to drink like Herman. I don't even like Herman. So why don't you drink like so-and-so? I said, fine, get him over to the house Saturday night. So-and-so would come over. I'd feed him alcohol like I'm undrinking. Come on, don't drink. Don't drink like a little girl, like a baby. Drink. Hour and a half later, that he'd be passed out on my living room rug. My foot would be on his navel. And I'd look at my wife and I'd say, and you want me to drink like this bum here? My wife used to say, why don't you drink like a man? I said, I'm drinking with both fists. What else you want me to do? Oh, here's a real good one. People used to say, David, don't you drink anymore. I didn't need any more. What I was drinking was doing the job. But once we succumb to the desire again, and unfortunately many of us will, here comes the thing that separates our kind from the social drinker. I was a social drinker. I drank with anybody. Normal drinker, I don't know what a normal drinker is. A normal drink for me used to be get you a pint of cheap whiskey, cheap wine, knock the cap off, sucker down in one swallow, and go for another one, you know. But once we succumb, then we succumb to this phenomenon of craving. My God, how my body craved alcohol when I was drinking. And that is where I found out what was wrong with me at that meeting in the last Sunday in August of 1950. Remember I told you I got up 5:30 in that morning and started drinking. Drank a half fifth. Knew I was going to have me a drink. No, it wasn't because I was sorry that I was no good, that I'd rather be drunk than sober. I didn't realize that I was suffering from a twofold illness of mind and body. Living a lifestyle on my own, a mental obsession so powerful that was condemning me to drink against my own will. And the physical nature of the thing that I had was condemning me to die if I continued to drink. I did not know this. No, no. And it wasn't that, no, and this phenomenon of craving, the body was craving that alcohol. And then once we sets up this phenomenon of craving, and we go through that well-known spree, ending up remorseful, screaming to anybody that would listen to us, we'll never do it again, yet I did it again and again and again and again and again. And here's where Dr. Silkworth lays out our recovery program so beautifully and so simply when he says, until such a person experiences an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. Well, how in Alcoholics Anonymous do we experience an entire psychic change? As a result of our ideals that are firmly grounded in a power greater than ourselves. And how in Alcoholics Anonymous do we firmly ground our ideals in a power greater than ourselves? Steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then our co-founders knew that we would be restless, irritable, and discontented. And the groups were beginning to break up. And anonymity breaks were running rampant and wild. And so enough time had distilled, and the drunk said, Bill, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And so Bill sat down and wrote 12 more spiritual principles by which we can not only live with, not only with each other in our AA groups, and our AA groups with other AA groups, the AA as a whole in the world which we live in, and that is our 12 traditions. And that first tradition is a honey. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Common problem, common solution, common recovery, common father, the oneness of one. And then in 1962, our conference, through Bill's writing, gave us 12 more spiritual principles to live by, and that is our 12 concepts of world service. So that the human being that's born right this very second, not too far from where we are meeting, that one day may become an alcoholic. AA will be with its arms open and waiting, with the ungarbled, simple message that has been so freely and lovingly given to every one of us, that AA will be available to come, and it is our responsibility. And basically, this is what I had been hearing all this weekend here at PRASA. Here at PRASA. Thank God. Thank God. You betcha. This is serious business. We can't monkey with other people's heads, and we can't monkey with other people's lives, because we have been given the gift to live again. The most precious gift that any human being has, and that's life itself. And in AA, all we do is renew that contact of that little precious thing that comes with each of us at birth. You betcha. And then Silky tells us what will happen to us once such a person has experienced this entire psychic change. A person who has been doomed helpless and hopeless and has so many problems, they'll never be able to comprehend how they'll ever be able to solve them, can now very easily control their desire for alcohol, the only thing being that they'd be willing to follow a few simple rules. Dr. Silkworth, being a non-alcoholic, he says rules. Our kinds, we do not like rules, we do not like regulations, we do not like to be told what to, what not to, we just say suggestions. But after you've been in AA for a while, them suggestions become rules.
Rich, I don't make a lot of money, I didn't have enough money to get over here on my own, and AA, an AA service, I don't believe is strictly for the wealthy. So what they did was they voted, and this was not my idea, this was their idea, that they suggested that what we do is we go back to the groups. And if the groups wanted me to attend PRASA as the DCM and to carry the message to PRASA and back from PRASA about what was going on here, we've never done this before and never considered doing it before, they went back and their groups responded overwhelmingly to contribute, to send me over here and to pay my entire way. What they did was they elected each group to pass a second basket for the specific purpose of sending me over here. And I have to say that it was extremely gratifying to me to see the groups on Maui respond in such a way. This has never happened before. There are groups from Lahaina and upcountry and all over the island that were contributing. And some groups were only able to contribute a few dollars. Other groups were able to contribute over $150 toward my airfare. This, to me, embodies the principle that we are self-supporting through our own contributions. And that's what I'd like to say, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I'd like to bring this, our business meeting to a close. Let's close with the Lord's Prayer, please.